what has happened in America to bring about our health decline? We changed the rules in the United States that on who gets what share of the pie. Poorer people don't vote. And the president can limit his actions to those that benefit the voters, namely the rich. So we have tax relief for the rich, and we have handouts for Enron, Bechtel, and Halliburton, among others. We've decided to let the rich grab as much as they can, and we'll be happy to take the crumbs. Poverty is not a certain amount of goods, but it's a form of invidious comparison with those who have more and with those who have less.
That's Stephen Bezruchka, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm Tanya Lowendorf. This edition of AR features Stephen Bezruchka on health and wealth. For most of us in the developed world, death is so remote we don't even concern ourselves with it. Later in life, it becomes a distant, inevitable reality, but still nothing for immediate concern. Then, as Rudyard Kipling wrote, man dies too soon, beside his works half planned. Health and longevity are based upon factors we can all acknowledge, genetics, lifestyle, and luck among them. They are also largely taken for granted. But as Stephen Bezruchka explains, social class has a far more profound effect in the U.S. than we realize, in ways we wouldn't guess, even for the many of us who consider ourselves middle class. Stephen Bezruchka is a senior lecturer at the University of Washington and works as an emergency room physician in Seattle. His particular areas of research are population health and societal hierarchy and its application to health. He is author of numerous articles and essays. His most recent contribution is to Sickness and Wealth, a collection of essays on the effects of global corporatization on health. Stephen Bezruchka spoke in Seattle, Washington.
I want to talk about how healthy we are in the United States of America, why we are less healthy now than we should be, how we used to be much healthier in comparison to other countries, and what we need to do to regain our health ranking. To consider the reasons why, we have to address issues of poverty, and the critical component about poverty that is related to health is what I call relative poverty, how you compare to others and how that affects our health. I will say that more than bringing the bottom up, we've got to bring the top down in order to achieve health in this society. So I'm going to give you a prescription for health. Now, it's really difficult to talk about poverty in the United States because so many of us don't identify with being poor. We're mostly all middle class, right? Being poor is a bad choice of words because it stigmatizes. So instead, I'm going to deal with people who have families and working people and people with low income who may be struggling to make ends meet. Because to admit that you're poor in America might mean that you'll be permanently poor, especially in the land of the American dream, namely that before we die, we'll all achieve wealth, happiness, and prosperity, own our own home, the big car, and all the other symbols of success. It all depends on us. We just have to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, work hard, and we can achieve anything we want. Aren't we entitled to that? That's all Bill Gates did. Maybe Magic Johnson, Oprah Winfrey. I don't know if that's true. Some people would say that Bill Gates was born into a very privileged family. The facts show, as others have said, we have much more poverty in the United States today than do all the other rich countries. That's not good. Let me tell you a bit about me. In the 1950s, my father repaired shoes, and we lived about above the shoe store in a small apartment. We didn't have a car for a long period of time. And we lived in a working-class neighborhood where everyone else was pretty much in the same shoes as we were. Although we had a TV by 1953, the programming back then was pretty basic, and it didn't display lifestyles of the rich and famous. So we didn't get a sense of how little we had, and we weren't made to want. So I never thought of myself as having less than other people till I went away to college and made friends with people who went off to Europe for the summer, who had vacation homes. Then I began to think of myself as lower class or working class. In fact, I remember having a discussion with a friend of mine in graduate school at Harvard University in which I described myself as working class. And Carl said, no, there's no way you could get to Harvard and be working class. And that was the case back in the 1960s. After graduate school, I spent a year in Nepal, a little country sandwiched between the highest mountains in the world where Mount Everest sits. There were no roads there, and there's still very few today. So to get anywhere, you had to walk. There were no lodges or hotels, so the travelers would have to stay in people's homes, eat their food, sleep around the fire at night with them, just as the families did with their children and grandparents. These people had next to nothing, yet they didn't seem to want anything. I know now why they didn't want anything, because there is no advertising of things that they should want. I spent a whole year totally without any form of advertising, and that was a profound experience. These people had the basics, food, water, shelter, and most importantly, the love and company of their family and community. And they shared this with me. They laughed, played, never let their children cry, and they seemed happy, and now I know they were. But if you saw them, you would call them desperately poor. Now, some of you might say I'm romanticizing the situation, describing the noble savage. So I used to think maybe I was wrong, but now I'm convinced that happiness and satisfaction are not something you can buy. So what about poverty and health? I've been working as a doctor for 30 years, much of that time spent in emergency rooms, trying to look after people's health problems that arise acutely. I started doing emergency care in 1977 because I thought that was really helpful for people. And I've continued to practice in emergency rooms in the U.S. for the last 25 years. I occasionally thought about the kind of people I would see in the ER, the kind of people having accidents or heart attacks or bringing their sick kids in. Mostly they seemed to have one thing in common. They weren't rich people. They weren't wealthy. Now, much of my time was spent working in ERs in Burien or White Center or Tacoma or Lakewood or near the Central District here in Seattle. There's a lot of low-income people living there, struggling to make ends meet. But I also worked in Bellevue, near where the richest person in the world lives, as well as the home of other billionaires and multimillionaires. What kind of patients did I see in the ER in Bellevue? Were they rich? Well, occasionally I would see someone that I might surmise was well off, but for the most part, the rich didn't come to that hospital. You might say that when they're in a hospital gown or strapped to a stretcher, it would be hard to tell whether they're rich or not. But even stripped naked, it's easy to tell. Why? Well, the poor people with low incomes interact differently with other people. Often they don't make eye contact with you and look down. Or if they do look at you, their eyes betray a tough life. Sometimes they're angry and rushed, wondering why they have to wait for so long. And for another thing, they tend to be more obese, sometimes much more. They also use words differently when we talk. They might say, "Doc, I got this serious pain in my stomach," rather than saying, "Doctor, I'm having some discomfort in my abdomen associated with loose movements." You might say that I'm saying that low-income people are dumb and didn't do well in English at school. They're certainly not stupid, and they speak English different than the rich, but it ain't wrong to speak that way. I began to think that maybe poorer people got sick more than rich people. You might counter that and say, no, the rich have their own private doctors and don't go to ERs, but call their doctors any time of the day or night. Well, I don't think that's so true in the middle of the night. You have to come to the hospital when your appendix bursts or you have a heart attack in the middle of the night, whether you're rich or poor. So what do you think? Are rich people as sick as working class people or people with low incomes? The studies overwhelmingly show that for every health condition, for every disease, for every cause of death, those with lower incomes have it much worse than those with fatter paychecks. In other words, if you work where you have to see sick people, as I do in emergency departments, you're going to see poorer people for the most part, no matter whether your hospital sits in a wealthy community or a poor one. Coming to see that, namely, that poorer people had poorer health, has been a major revelation for me. Now, I'm not saying that all rich people live long, healthy lives and that people of more modest means live shorter, sicker lives. We all know about counterexamples to that. The tragedy of Princess Diana comes to mind. But I'm making a statement about populations, about communities. Wherever you look at it, poorer people have poorer health. The next question I ask is, why is this so? Why do people with lower incomes get sick more? Is it because they smoke more? Which they do. Is it because they drink more? Well, they might, I don't know. Is it because they shoot up more heroin? Which is true. Is it because they eat more? That's true. Is it because they don't exercise as much? Well, they don't. But studies show that these behaviors that we consider bad for health explain only about 10% of the reason that poorer people have poorer health. That's been the revelation for me over the last 10 years. You know, I used to be so down on people's behavior. They used to get complaints working in the ER for harping on people to quit smoking. Here I have this chronic lunger patient, and he continues to deteriorate, and he keeps up his two-pack-a-day habit. And the patient's families would complain to the administrator that all I could do is tell him to quit. Isn't there something else you could do? He's trying to quit, but he can't. So, like most people, I used to blame sick people for the behaviors that made them sick. I don't now. I blame myself for allowing the rules that govern our society to produce the behaviors that are bad for us. Is it because lower-income people can't afford health care? Is that why they get sick more? It's tempting to say that that's the reason, but it isn't. I know some of you here may not have health insurance. Perhaps some of you here have huge medical bills that you're struggling to pay. Health care, or the lack of it, doesn't explain why poorer people have poorer health. Consider the Hispanic population. They don't access health care very much. They tend not to have medical insurance. They tend to not go to the doctor. Quite a few studies show this, and it represents a cause for concern. What is often not stated is that Hispanic people tend to be healthier than non-Hispanic whites. It isn't because they don't see doctors, although that's a tempting thought. As a rule, most Hispanics are comparatively less well off than non-Hispanic whites, so later I'll try and present my opinion as to why they're the exception to the poorer people have poorer health concept. Now, I expect you to be skeptical on this, but I would proceed with the observation that it's not the behaviors that matter, and it's not access to medical care or the kind of medical care that poorer people receive that accounts for the difference. A lot of studies on this and science on the subject, but it's not intuitive. But I want you to suspend your disbelief. By its very nature, medical care can't have much to do with health. To consider why, I make the analogy that medical care's role in our society is about the same as the Army Medical Corps in keeping us healthy. You've been reading about all these soldiers that are coming home from Iraq with legs blown off and other serious injuries. Our media has been forbidden to show coffins of our troops coming home, but there have been many deaths, as you know. Now, the Army Medical Corps goes in after the blast and picks up the victims, splints the limbs, starts IVs, transports them to where they can get blood, and then to a field hospital where the bullet holes are closed. Other heroics are carried out, and hopefully the stricken soldiers survive. And we feel grateful in these cases. But most casualties, those who die, are killed outright by the bullet hole, the blast, or the bomb. Now, the Army Medical Corps can't do anything for them. They're killed outright. The Army Medical Corps also didn't decide that we were going to invade Iraq. They didn't decide the battle strategies. They didn't decide that we were going to go in from the air and bomb civilian targets. They didn't decide on the protective gear that the troops would wear. They didn't decide on the day-to-day combat decisions. All they do is go in and pick up the pieces and hope to keep the survivors alive. So by its very nature, if medical care is like the Army Medical Corps, it can't have very much to do with health of a population. If it could decide to invade Iraq or not, if the Army Medical Corps made that decision, then maybe it would have a bigger role. Now, in my courses at the University of Washington, I go to great details about these issues, and as a practicing doctor, I believe that medical care's role is very limited. And colleagues of mine who've considered it and expert books and papers on the subject present the same story. It's not medical care that makes a population healthy. It's not that I don't believe in medical care. I work as a doctor continuing to provide medical care. And I teach young doctors as well. And if I'm sick, I go see a doctor. And if I suddenly collapse, I want you to call 911. But don't deceive ourselves and think that this is what makes us healthy as a population. Now, I expect you to be skeptical on this, but I'm going to proceed with the observation that it is people of lesser means that are sicker, and it's not their behaviors and it that makes them sicker, or medical care or lack of access to medical care that does. So maybe you're asking, why do poorer people have poorer health? I think that's the right question to ask. Thomas Pynchon wrote in Gravity's Rainbow, if they can get you asking the wrong question, the answers don't matter. I think we ask too many wrong questions in America today. What does matter is the nature of our relationships with each other, the social nature of our societies, the psychosocial element. And let's explore that. Think of health as the expression of our life's experiences. We all know the physical effect that stress has on our minds and bodies, our immune systems, our ability to fight off disease. The reason that poorer people have poorer health has something to do with the very basic nature of living in poverty, especially when you live amidst plenty and you have that rubbed in your face. That is what being a family with low income is all about. If I were to ask you in this room how many of you consider yourselves poor, I think fewer hands would go up than if I asked if you were middle class. If you admit you're poor, you're shaming yourself, and feeling shamed is an essential human emotion when it comes to understanding health. Now, many people with lower incomes, many disadvantaged people, won't admit feeling shame, but they feel the shame deep inside. So doesn't it make sense that feelings, these kinds of feelings, would have a major impact on our physical as well as our mental health? So let's address further what poverty means. What does it mean living with low incomes in the United States or Seattle? Let me start by leaving out the homeless. There are more than 1 million homeless children in the United States, richest, most powerful country in world history. I don't know how many homeless there are in total, but I've seen statistics, for example, that there are 1.5 million homeless in California alone. In 2001, there was a count on one night of the homeless in King County, and there were 7,350. So I would imagine the number of homeless in this country is somewhere between 10 and 20 million. Now, for many of you who are older like me, if you think back 25 years and reflect on whether you saw homeless then or not, you probably might see one a week or one a month, if that. These days, you can see one a minute pretty easily. Now, the reason that we have the homeless is because President Ronald Reagan cut the funding for low-income housing in 1981, and suddenly there they were in the streets. I'm not going to talk any more about homelessness, but what about the poor who are almost homeless? What's their situation like? These people are often one paycheck away from being evicted. In Washington, a worker earning the minimum wage, which is $7.01 an hour, has to work 86 hours a week to afford a two-bedroom unit at the state's median fair market rent. But even if you're not so poor, is it because you don't have enough to eat or a roof over your head or central heating? Is it because you don't have a microwave or a refrigerator? You don't have a TV or a VCR? Is it because you don't have a cell phone? No. Many low-income people have all these items, and they aren't close to being evicted, and yet they feel disadvantaged. 50 years ago, the rich didn't have microwave ovens. They didn't have VCRs or cell phones. Now, many low-income families have them. So it's important to note that being less well-off is not about having stuff, such as cellular phones and VCRs, that would have been considered science fiction devices 50 years ago. Being less well-off is about feeling you don't have the choices that the more well-off do. It's not about the stuff you have. I said it was low-income people that are obese. They have enough to eat. People in subsidized housing areas have a lot of stuff, but still they feel disadvantaged. And my years of emergency department experience shows that these are the ones that get sick. And so in a very profound sense, these disadvantaged people don't live as long or as healthy lives as the rich. Now, take me at this point. I'm not poor now. As I said, I grew up in a working-class neighborhood, and my father repaired shoes. And we lived above a shoe store. And I mentioned how I didn't feel poor until I went away and left my neighborhood and was amongst people who had more than I did. Then I began to feel poor because I made comparisons of myself with other people. Well, I've flooded you now with the concept of class. I'm waging class warfare, as some politicians might say. We have to be honest. That's what it's all about today. It is class warfare. There's a war going on right now, and it is the rich who are attacking everybody else. In fact, this war has been going on for about the last 10,000 years. But class warfare has been worse these last few years, although our leaders will deny it even exists. The weapons of class warfare are symbolic missiles shot through our media, TV, magazines, movies, the internet, and it starts at a very young age. What are really pornography internet sites that our children are exposed to are not the crass sex, but the Nike websites or the movie star websites. The Nike sites display their shoes and the stars their environments. These are signs that the rich are winning the class warfare battles. Another sign is that people with low incomes are naming their newborns Gucci and Armani and other icons found on designer labels. In ERs, I see people who've been attacked and robbed, and the key thing the robber got away with was their Nike tennies, the brand new Nike tennies. So the essence of class warfare is that rich make you compare yourself with others and make you consider that you're less well off than they are. That's their weapon. That's their Scud missile. If you're rich, it doesn't mean you have more stuff. What it means is that if you want it, you can have it. You can do what you want. My friend Raymond, who made a lot of money, said he took care of his problems with the check principle. If he had a problem, he would find somebody to take care of it and write them a check. Most of us can't do that. Now, our societies exhibit many features of baboon troops in Africa. There's the alpha male, the top dog, and then there's those below the alpha male in the pecking order. The alpha male gets the best food, the pick of the females to mate with. The beta and gamma males have very different lives. Those lower down on the pecking order are always looking over their shoulders that the alpha male might come and take this piece of food that they just found, or the alpha male will come and mate with the female that you were just about to. So their lives are under constant stress. We know that the alpha male is healthier than the beta and gamma males. The alpha males actually have different physiology, a different stress response than the baboons lower down. So the lower down baboons are less healthy than the high-ranking baboons, and human studies show the same thing. People with low incomes have a different stress response than rich people. They have more of the stress response of low-ranking baboons. So, as with baboons or humans, being lower down in the status ladder means you suffer more from chronic stress. This results in higher blood pressures, less ability to control glucose in your blood, more adult onset diabetes. In fact, we're seeing more adult onset diabetes in younger children as they suffer more stress. Results in more fat deposition around the waist and hips, more plaque and coronary arteries that supply the heart, and so we have more heart attacks in poorer people. As well, those lower down in the ladder have less ability to fight infection because their immune systems aren't as good as those in rich people. They're not able to search and destroy cancer cells as well. So having low income in America means that you aren't in the same league as those having higher status in our society. You generally don't do well at school. You're more likely to be raised in a home where your mother has to work at several jobs to make ends meet. You may not know who your father is. You won't have a fancy car or designer label clothes, or won't go to France for the weekend. Or more likely, you will have a few status symbols like Nike shoes and will spend for these icons of status and not be able to afford health care. You'll tend to eat at fast food places and shop in convenience stores. If you have a car, you'll pay more money for gasoline unless you travel to the cheaper gas stations, which are usually not in the poorer parts of town. If you don't have a car, you're going to ride the shame train or take the bus, and you won't feel so secure walking down the street. Now, these effects begin when you're just a gleam in your parents' eyes. That is, the effects of class and social ranking begin to affect your parents' physiology and their biology and your pathophysiology at a very early age. And the studies suggest the critical time in health as adults is from conception to age 2. Perhaps you have a job doing work that needs to be done. You do it well. Jobs that some people might consider menial, such as working as a custodian in a building after hours when the executives go home. Or you may work as a nurse's aide in a nursing home. Or you may work at that convenience store or be flipping burgers. You might find yourself suppressing your rage when the boss goes by. But if you're nice enough, you might get a Christmas present at the end of the year. Even if you are nice enough, you might get laid off at the next economic downturn. And most likely, you'll have two or three jobs, all of them part-time, with no security or benefits. Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank, talked about the booming economy in the 1990s being partly because of a flexible labor force. Namely, workers with very low wages could be laid off at will. I'm sure you agree that that's good for the economy to be flexible like that, but it isn't good for you, and it's not good for your health to be that insecure. So one thing that's been happening in the last 30 years in America is that most people are not doing well. Not only are they homeless out in droves, but poverty, no matter how you measure it, has increased dramatically over this period of incredible prosperity. And this isn't just true in America, but is more and more true worldwide, as I'm sure you are aware. So there are more poor people. The biblical promise is true. The poor you shall always have with you. Only today it is the poor shall be ever more with you. All this in a time of phenomenal wealth. So my main point is that the culture of poverty, the culture of inequality that surrounds us has the most significant effect on our health. Every rung in society's status ladder from the top to the bottom will have their health determined by where they stand on that ladder. The poorer you are, the worse your health in comparison to others. So stated very simply, societies with a big gap between those on top and those on the bottom will be less healthy than societies where there's a smaller gap. To consider this, look at the health of us in the United States of America, measured by average number of years lived, the life expectancy. 55 years ago, the United States was one of the healthiest countries in the world by this measure, average number of years lived. Today, there are 25 countries that are healthier than we are. Think of it, all the other rich countries are healthier than we are, as well as a few poor ones. Now, it's not just this one measure, life expectancy, average number of years lived, in which we do poorly, but in every other measure of health status, comparing ourselves with other countries, we do worse than all the other rich countries. Yes, we are living longer, but not as long as people in 25 other countries. And all those countries happen to be poorer as a country than we are. So we have the highest infant mortality rate, the highest child poverty rate, the highest teen pregnancy rate, the highest child abuse death rate, and so on, among all rich countries. There's no indicator that we excel in except spending money on health care. We spend half of the world's health care bill in the United States.
You're listening to Stephen Bezruchka on Health and Wealth. This is Alternative Radio. You can get copies of this program by calling toll-free 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go to our website at alternativeradio.org. Stay tuned at the end for complete details on ordering.
Out of every dollar spent worldwide, 50 cents is spent in America. Yet our citizens are less healthy than all the other rich countries. And by less healthy, I don't mean how long we live, but in these other indicators of health as well, such as teen pregnancy rates, such as homicides, such as incarceration rates. In fact, we house one quarter of the world's prisoners here in the United States, which says something very significant about how we deal with petty crime in this country. So what has happened to cause this huge disaster? Simply, we have changed the rules in this country as to who gets what share of the pie. Back 50 years ago, it was the poorest fifth of American families that saw the highest percentage gain in income. Now, we all know that it's only the rich and super rich that are seeing gains in income, while the rest of us have to tighten our belts. This may not seem right in explaining the reason for our poor health, but it's really true. We've changed the rules in society, created more poor people, and that's why your health and my health is not as good as it could be. Now, racism is another way that the gap operates to create worse health. Racism is all about difference and power. And minorities have always been put down and feel the shame, even if they don't think about it. The rich want to continue to put people down, and they use ever more subtle means. If you can put people down, if you can make them afraid, if you can make them want things, then you have power over them. An African-American male in Harlem lives less long than a man in Bangladesh. one of the world's poorest countries. Black man in Washington, D.C. doesn't live as long as a man in Ghana, a country in West Africa. Now, women tend to be healthier and live longer than men. Studies show that where women play a bigger role in the political life and communities, they're even healthier. What is more astounding is that men's health improves even more in those situations than the gain for women. In other words, we all do better where women do better, and probably most of you here know that. I want to point out how much our health relative to other countries has declined in the last 55 years. Consider if we won the war on heart disease. You remember, we're always winning wars. Heart disease, it's the plague that will kill half of us in this room. If we had no more deaths from heart attacks, we still wouldn't be the healthiest country in the world. And yet, 55 years ago, we were one of those healthiest. The difference now is that we live under more stressful conditions, a stress caused by the big gap between the rich and the rest of us. And yet, when we go shopping at The Gap, that symbolic store, The Gap, we don't even realize why this is the key problem in America. So how is it that a big gap society has worse health than a more egalitarian society? Consider two extremes: an egalitarian society where everyone is more or less equal, and a very hierarchical one where there are a few fabulously wealthy rich and the rest of us. Sort of like the United States. What is life like in an egalitarian society? What are the prevailing relationships and feelings? Think about it. Wouldn't they be those of friendship, support, caring, trust, sharing, community? Don't those words sound kind of healthy? Think of the opposite extreme. What's it like inside such a population? Wouldn't those on top, the people with wealth and power, dominate others, compel and coerce those below them to get things done? What do the rest of us do? We resign ourselves to our job and our role, but we feel humiliated and shamed. I think shame is the critical emotion at work. And none of those feelings in a hierarchical society of power, domination, and resentment and resignation and shame sound healthy, do they? But in countries such as the United States of America, those are the prevailing relationships at work, even though we all think we're middle class. And there's an increasing gap between the rich and the poor here. In a big gap society, it isn't just the rich putting everyone else down. It happens in stages. Those above push down those below. And it goes all the way down. And that helps explain why we have the highest homicide rates among all rich countries. How about other countries that are healthier than we are? Costa Rica, for example. It's a nearby country that is pretty egalitarian, and even though it's much, much poorer than the United States, is healthier than we are. Canada, our neighbor to the north, is much healthier than the United States. And a final example is Cuba. Now, we've been strangling Cuba for the last 44 years, yet it's as healthy as we are. Now, all these sanctions and embargoes, despite those, or maybe in spite of them, Cuba is as healthy as we are. Consider the healthiest country in the world, Japan. 55 years ago, when we were one of the healthiest countries in the world, right after the Second World War, Japan was less healthy compared to other countries than we are today. It was either even further behind in what I call the Health Olympics in 1946 than we are today. Yet, we, people in the United States of America, gave Japan the medicine it needed to become the healthiest country in the world by 1978. The medicine was prescribed by the greatest population health doctor that ever lived. He was General Douglas MacArthur. The medicine was administered during our occupation of that country from 1945 to 1950, and it had three ingredients. And I'm going to review the ingredients here. The first was demilitarization. Japan was forbidden to have an army. The second ingredient was democratization. MacArthur wrote the constitution for that country, providing for a representative democracy, providing for free universal education, providing for the right of labor unions to organize and engage in collective bargaining, and providing for the right of everyone to a decent and cultured life. The third ingredient, was decentralization. MacArthur broke up the 11 big family corporations or zaibatsu that ran the country. MacArthur legislated a maximum wage. And in 1946, it was the equivalent of $4,333 in Japan. If you were a former zaibatsu boss, your wage was $2,600, a lower wage for the former bosses. He also carried out the most successful land reform program in history. What MacArthur did was take that big higher economic hierarchy and shrink it to level the playing field, and the rise in health in Japan has been the most profound ever observed in the planet. Now, looking at Japan presents some interesting issues about the health of populations. For example, Japanese men smoke the most of men in all rich countries. Yet they're the healthiest population on the planet. It seems you can smoke in Japan and get away with it. It's not that smoking is good for you, but compared to other things, it's not that bad. Now, smoking is much worse if you do it in the United States than it is in Japan, because the gap between the rich and the poor is much smaller there. So I tell people if they want to smoke that they should be born in Japan. Similarly, it isn't Japan's healthcare system that is responsible for its remarkable health. For one thing, they spend half of what we do per capita, and if anyone's looked at the system, you find that it isn't much to write home about. I talked before about designer labels, and if you probe, you find that everyone in Japan shops at designer stores and buys the Gucci icons. That's the key element. Everyone has them. In the United States, everyone wants them, and that's the difference. Japan is a caring and sharing society that looks after everyone, and that matters most for your health. Let me give my opinion now on why Hispanics have better health in the United States than non-Hispanic whites. It has to do with the support they give one another and their strong family ties that counter the adverse effects of the gap in their poverty. This is called the Hispanic paradox in epidemiology. And I came to understand the reasons by reflecting on the Hispanic patients I would see in the ER. I never saw a single Hispanic patient. There was always a group of people huddled together, and I had to go in there and figure out who the patient was, because everybody's come to offer support. By contrast, I'm more likely to see a white person lying there writhing in pain alone. So we can conclude that it's the nature of psychosocial relationships, the support that people give and take in a society and offer, that is responsible for their health as communities, more than any other factor. So what has happened in America to bring about our health decline? We changed the rules in the United States on who gets what share of the pie, how we decide where to spend tax dollars, how we decide who to tax and how much, how we decide to fund basic research and development, how we decide to give subsidies to various elements of society. Instead of trying to make the rules level the playing field, we've decided to let the rich grab as much as they can, and we'll be happy to take the crumbs. I say we'll be happy because if I ask many, if not most Americans, whether they feel the rich should get as much as they do, you'll get an answer something like, of course, the rich deserve it because they work hard and they're better than we are. Or something else like, yes, I'm in favor of having a big gap between the rich and the poor because someday I'm going to strike it rich and I want to have it all. So we've been seduced into believing in the American dream, the rags to riches myth, the Horatio Alger stories, where if we just work hard enough, we can achieve anything we want. The American dream, ladies and gentlemen, is a nightmare. Among all countries studied, we have the lowest percentage of people making it, in the sense of going from rags to riches, whether in one generation or two. That's what the economists who've studied this show. The price we pay for believing in the American dream is, I say, the ultimate price. Namely, you and I die younger than we need to. So much younger, it's equivalent to winning the war on heart disease. Now, our president speaks of the estate tax as the death tax. It really should be called the death-averting tax because it helps to narrow the gap a little bit and averts deaths. As he signs more tax cuts on the rich into law, he should be honest and tell you that this is a small price to pay for living in the richest and most powerful country in world history, namely, you live less healthy and die much younger than you need to. But the rich are appreciative all the way to the bank. What even they don't know is that they die younger than they should by living in this country. In other words, if the rich were less rich in a country with a smaller gap, they would be healthier. So if we're going to ask the right question at this point, it may be something along the lines of, what happened? How did we let things get to this point? And our story begins at the end of the Second World War. It was a difficult period for the world and for Americans, and we lost many lives in that conflict. Many people suffered without dying by serving in the war effort. So it was felt after the war that these people needed to be taken care of. And the oldest among you might remember the GI loans, the housing loans, the education bills that allowed vets to go to school. Our tax structure was very different then, too. Compared to today, the rich paid over 90% on the top chunk of income instead of today 35%. Now, the tax rate on the bottom strata of society has remained at about 25% ever since the end of the Second World War. And so the rich pay proportionately less tax than they did 55 years ago, and the rest of us, well, who pays the tax in this country? You have to look in the mirror. So after the Second World War, our businesses and industry did very well with technological advances and all the work in rebuilding Europe. They enjoyed high profit margins on revenue, and they were happy. But towards the 1960s and 1970s, their profits declined because of competition from Japan and the other East Asian economies that began in earnest. In 1940, corporations paid 40% of the federal tax bill. But with declining profits, they managed to demand lower tax rates, just as the rich did, so that by 1960, corporations paid 26% of the federal tax bill. By 1990, they were still at work with the government, so they were only paying 13% of the federal tax bill by 1990. And they continue to enjoy huge government subsidies. In other words, the taxes we paid went into their coffers in many ways that probably some of you are familiar with. Of course, the rich and powerful have only wanted one thing throughout history, and that is everything. So by 2002, corporations paid only 7% of the federal tax bill. As Greg Palast says, we have the best democracy money can buy. And these rich corporations buy themselves tax breaks and huge government subsidies by funding so-called democracy. Another way to look at this is how much we pay our CEOs, the heads of our corporations. In 1980, we paid them 40 times what an entry-level worker made on average. By 1999, they were paid 476 times what an entry-level worker made. And in 2001, in the Fortune 100 companies, the CEOs were paid 1,000 times what an entry-level worker made. If we ask what's the maximum wage in the United States, it's around $150,000 an hour. And this person got a $10,000 an hour raise over last year, despite his company's stock dropping 67% in value. As we say in America, nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try. Now in Canada, our much healthier neighbor to the north, the CEO worker pay gap is about 20 to 1, and in Japan, the healthiest country in the world, it's 11 to 1. Now in the recent economic downturn in Japan, what did CEOs and managers do? Lay off workers and take pay raises? No, they took pay cuts rather than laying off workers. That's not what our CEOs do. You know, they lay off 40,000 workers and give themselves a bonus for increasing efficiency. This isn't good for our health, is it? So if corporations used to pay 40% of the tax bill and now only pay 7%, where's the rest coming from? As I said, look in the mirror. Since the 1950s, the working class have paid proportionately more taxes than the rich. And today's tax relief for the rich, boy, the rich are really hurting, they need tax relief, is just the latest example. I'm sure that all of you in this room paid more tax than our biggest employer in Washington State did in 1995. That is, you paid more tax than Boeing did in 1995 unless you got more than a $33 million tax credit that year. Maybe that applies to some of you, I'm not sure. It's one thing to talk about income, the take-home paycheck that you're all familiar with. But what really matters is assets, wealth. Remember, you're sitting on your assets. And the gap in wealth is even more obscene than the gap in income. The richest 10% in this country have 80% of the assets in this country. The richest 1% have over 40% of the wealth. So there isn't much left for you and I, is there? Matter of fact, from 1983 to 1995, the bottom 40% of families in the United States actually lost wealth. They lost assets. At the same time, as you know, we've been doing everything we can to make life worse for the middle, for the working class. We cut funding for low-income housing, throwing millions on the street. We've cut funding for public schools with the result that our students score worse on international development, on international achievement test comparisons. We've done everything we can to decimate the family at the same time as we preach family values. We have the highest percentage of single-person households among all rich countries and the greatest number of children being raised in single-parent families. Now, it would be nice if the parent was there to raise the child. But instead, we force the parent to work at several low-paid, insecure jobs and leave child-rearing to the wolves. Studies have shown in Sweden that being raised in a single-parent family is bad for the child's health. Not only the children raised in a single-parent family in Sweden get sicker, spend more time in hospitals, and have more behavioral problems, they have higher mortality. That is, in a country like Sweden that has all these social supports that are unimagined in the United States, kids being raised in single-parent families die more. Why? Well, it isn't that these homes in Sweden lack stuff, but the mother isn't there to provide the time for the child, and in the end, that's the critical factor. For early childhood to lead to good adult health, secure attachment to a parent is the key health-promoting factor. It's the most important preventive medicine. It's the most important piece of preventive health care we could do is ensure for the mother-child secure attachment to occur in early life. But Clinton decided to end welfare as we know it, and our children are paying the price with their poorer health and the greater likelihood of ending up in a coffin. If you're a single mom, please don't think I'm trying to make you feel guilty by suggesting your child wouldn't do so well if you were married. My son, now 21, was not raised in a two-parent family, and I wish it were otherwise because I think he would be healthier in that situation. But the reasons families split up are basically political and economic and could be changed. Most of us think it's personal reasons that are involved, and while that's true at an individual level, it is the structure of society that makes this happen, and this will help us understand why family breakup has become more common. So in the last 55 years, we've drastically changed the rules of who gets what share of the pie. For our health, yours and mine, and that of the rich, we've got to change them again so we all get pretty well equal pieces of the pie. So poverty is bad for your health. Relative poverty, living in a large gap society, is the worst part of poverty. Poverty is not a certain amount of goods, but it's a form of invidious comparison with those who have more and with those who have less. If the gap between the rich and the poor is smaller, the comparisons we make are milder. When the playing field is more level, it's easier to play. And that's what justice is all about. Avoiding having one part of the society carrying most of the burden but reaping none of the benefits. So what can we do about this? Well, as I said, I learned a great deal from comparing ourselves with people in other countries. And I was surprised to learn that we have the lowest voter turnout of all democracies. In other words, fewer people vote in this country than in any other democracy. And in the last election here in King County, only 29% of the voters cast their ballots. And as was pointed out, who doesn't vote? It's the young and those with less income. Poorer people don't vote. If they don't vote, there's no need to have any policies that favor those with less income. And the president can limit his actions to those that benefit the voters, namely the rich. So we have tax relief for the rich and the end of the death tax, which only benefits the very rich. And we have handouts for Enron, Bechtel, and Halliburton, among others. So we need to get our voices heard. Has any major leader drawn attention to the fact that the working class doesn't vote and tried to encourage them to vote or design programs to get poorer people more involved in the process of democracy? No way. Why would they want to shoot themselves in the foot? So no, your leaders are not going to look out for your interests unless you force them to do so. They're not going to make voting day a holiday, as is the case in most other rich countries. They're not going to make it easier to register to vote. And they will continue to have laws excluding people such as felons from voting. The rich aren't dumb. Low-income people aren't dumb either, but they've been demoralized and think their vote doesn't count. Now, I remember the 1960s. I remember the Vietnam War movement. I remember the riots in the inner cities. And I remember the civil rights movement. And many more people voted then. Well, in the early 70s, the Trilateral Commission investigated this. And their report, titled The Crisis of Democracy, talks about what if democracy as it existed in the 1960s continued. It would be a crisis. They talked in this book about there could be an excess of democracy. Think about that. That was the problem of the 1960s. We had an excess of democracy. And so the Trilateral Commission's report, titled The Crisis of Democracy, was to find ways to minimize having further crises. So things are only going to change when we work together for our interests, not the interests of the rich. We've got to say no to more handouts for the rich. They have enough. They don't really need more. Although I must admit, when I'm around rich doctors, all they ever talk about is how they want more. That's what the rich are like. So if the poor organized, if the working class got together, it would be a piece of cake to change things. After all, the working class is the majority in this country. If you remember that, you're the majority. All you've got to do is talk amongst yourselves about these ideas, speak up, begin to voice your needs, push for policies that represent the status that working people used to have in America before we gave it away to the rich. Then our health will begin to improve compared to other countries. We need to shape the world that creates our life experiences and hence shapes our health. This is not the land of equal opportunity. Unless you believe that a few people are naturally born to ride while the rest of us are born to be saddled, it's a sign that opportunity is less than equal. The only way out that I know of for those who are saddled today is to throw off those saddles and chase after the riders and put them in their place. Because we vastly outnumber those riders. So working together and organizing is our hope for improving our health as a nation. We need to bring back the crisis of democracy. Those who aren't rich, those who are who work, are our country's hope for population health doctors. You're the people who need to prescribe the medicine that will get more assets into the hands of our children, that will increase taxes on the rich, that will break down the power of the corporations, and that will restore power to labor, that will give subsidies to those that need them rather than those who already have too much. The way to fight organized money is with organized people. It was Mahatma Gandhi who said, "First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, and then you win." And Martin Luther King said, "True compassion is more than flinging a coin at a beggar. It comes to see that an edifice that produces beggars needs restructuring." Now, I talked about Dr. MacArthur, the greatest population health doctor ever. Now, you out there can administer the MacArthur medicine. Remember the three ingredients. The three D's, demilitarization, democratization, and decentralization, bringing down the Walmarts. We can either take the same medicine we gave Japan, that is, we can take our own medicine, or we can ask Japan to give it to us. Thank you.
That was Stephen Bezruchka on health and wealth. Bezruchka is a senior lecturer at the University of Washington and works as an emergency room physician in Seattle. His areas of research are population health and societal hierarchy and its application to health. He is author of numerous articles and essays. Bezruchka spoke in Seattle, Washington. This program was produced by Alternative Radio, an independent, award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. AR features diverse voices such as Noam Chomsky, Arundhati Roy, Tariq Ali, Bill Moyers, and Michael Parenti. To access our catalog or place a secure online order, visit our website at alternativeradio.org. Again, that website address is alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for the complete one-hour program you just heard, Stephen Bezruchka on Health and Wealth, call us toll-free at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. You can send us a check. CDs and tapes are $16. Printed transcripts are $9. Please specify which format you'd like. Our address is AR, P.O. Box 551, Boulder, Colorado, 8306. This program was produced in part at the KGNU Studios in Boulder. David Barsamian is AR's director. I'm Tanya Lowendorf. Thank you for listening.